WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Joining me in the studio now is Mae Rockland, who's the author of a book called The Jewish Yellow Pages. It's a mail-order catalog type of book. You don't have to mail away, of course, for anything, but it's kind of like a whole earth catalog of Jewish goods and services. There are there's a chapter on artists, for instance, which in many cases has photographs of their work. And these artists are people who are working in various media, but the work that they produce is related to Judaism. There's everything from that to where to buy good bagels many other related items. May is also the author of a number of other books, including The Work of Our Hands, Jewish Needlecraft for Today, and The Hanukkah Book, which was published in 1975 by Shachan Books, and we'll also be speaking a little bit about the history of Hanukkah. May Shafter Rockland now lives in New Jersey. She is a graphic and textile artist, and she's had several one-woman shows of her work in Madrid, Buenos Aires, and Minneapolis, and she's also a member of the American Crafts Council. You say, I think it's in the introduction to your book, May, that you kind of hope it to be something that can offer an alternative to tawdry traditional fare. And I thought maybe that's a good place to start by talking about what the tawdry stuff you're referring to is.
Well, let me just talk from my own experience. When I was newly married and my husband and I went to Japan, he was drafted into the Navy. I think it was the first naval draft since World War II. And we were in Japan, and it was our first Passover. And my dear mother-in-law, who I'm very fond of, we've been married now 21 years, so she's been around a long time with us, sent me, to make sure that I'd have everything I needed for Passover, a matzah cover. And it was made of white satin, and it had satiny, silky fringes and some gold and silver cord sewed onto it in what appeared to be a traditional design. And I had just finished school, and my training has been always as a craftsperson and as an artist, and I'd been working in ceramics, working in wood, and the satin, silvery, glittery thing had no relation to me as an artist or craftsperson, no relation to anything I felt about Passover. All I could think of it as was sort of a 20th century reproduction of a 19th century reproduction of a 17th century Baroque doodad, and it didn't relate to me at all. So I decided then, and I'd use it because my mother-in-law had sent it, but that I would really make my own from then on. And that was, quite a while ago. It was about 19 years ago. And little by little, I began making more of the things that I wanted for our own Jewish holiday, simply because I couldn't find what I wanted in the stores, that, things that were as nice or at least went with the rest of my lifestyle, which is something between, antique-y, artsy, craftsy or something. But certainly the blue and brass patina things that we're familiar with from the usual Jewish Center gift shop things, the plastic dreidels, the over-ornamented religious items that don't, as far as I'm concerned, add any feeling of sanctity to the items, they offend me as an artist. They don't enhance my Jewish life. I can only say that in that they're traditional, they have a certain, maybe a little gloss of nostalgia over them. That's the most I can say for them. So when I began to compile the Jewish Yellow Pages, I was very eager and then happy to find that there are many craftspeople and artists feeling as I do and who produce a wide variety of work in many different styles, some perhaps leaning towards the Baroque, but authentic, let's say, 20th century original Baroque or Ungepachtet, as we say, and then, of course, the simple contemporary look.
There's, I think, a big identification, in spite of the tawdriness of a lot of the Jewish items, from menorahs to small Bibles to dreidels, that I think people identify with somehow. For instance, if you're kind of brought up in a household, no matter what your religion or what culture it is, if the items are something different than handcrafted or something that purports to be authentic and mm-hmm. is really, as you say, a copy of a copy of a copy. It's difficult to really learn the difference, I think, for many people between what really is a meaningful craft and what is a kind of commercial replica, and to draw value judgments between them.
Maybe this was truer. There's the nostalgia kick. You know, if it's what I had when I was a kid, even if it's plastic or even if it's, you know, sort of schlocky, it's what I'm familiar with. But I think that today's Jews, there's a lot happening. Young people, let's say in their early 20s or late teens, many of them, they grew up with only gift shop reproductions, Reform Synagogue gift shop reproductions of Lower East Side, and that's, you know, it gets even further afield. And yet, they're all, with the help of things like the Whole Earth Catalog, turning back to the crafts. They're very interested in making everything for themselves and have, I think, a greater feel for it. Even your, let's say, typical suburban housewife whose idea of a craft project would be, let's say, a needlepoint kit, she's rather sophisticated. Even, let's say, her level of taste may be not beyond green stamp contemporary. But still, I think a lot of green stamp contemporary is better than what I would call tawdry traditional. So at least if we could raise the level of Judaica to that point. Also, I think people are really very responsive. What a kid wants at Hanukkah is a dreidel. Now, I think the response to, let's say, the redwood dreidels made by two California couples who really were fed up with the plastic dreidels that they could only find for their kids, and they took to their basement and they began making these really beautiful dreidlach out of redwood. And they sell them $3 for $5, which is, you know, they hand burn in the letters. I think anyone responds very positively to that. The form is traditional, even the letters that they have burned in are the traditional kind of letters rather than a contemporary, let's say, Hebrew alphabet.
How did you find all these artists who you've included in your book?
Well, a lot of them I sort of accumulated over the years of friends and colleagues. We would be in one show or another together, and often these were not Jewish craft shows, but if they were doing anything Jewish or if they were Jewish and I contacted them. And then the artists that I knew really over a number of years, because as I say, I've been doing it since about 1960. I've been working in graphics and textiles, ceramics too. I wrote to them, asked them for the names of their friends. Their friends had other friends, and it just began to circle out like a pebble in a pond with great radiating waves of water. And people then began to find me. Which was very gratifying, and I sent them questionnaires, asking for photographs, asking for samples if they could spare them, and people were very generous with their photos, slides, and work. Maybe the reason for their generosity was that I specified in my letter that the way they dealt with me, in a sense, would tell me how well I could expect them to treat the eventual reader of the book, because my big fear is that I'll list someone and say, this person's really great, a wonderful craftsman, right, and all that. Then someone will write to them and say, hey, please send me, you know, a hand-done ketubah, and they'll never produce, or they'll never be willing to correspond about it, you know, and that would be just a waste.
Do most of the artists who you've listed there base all their work on Judaism, or if you know what I'm saying, for instance, the people who you refer to who make redwood dreidels, is all their crafts related to Judaism?
The only craft these redwood dreidel people are into are redwood and bronze dreidels. They are, in reality, one, the man is an engineer, and his wife, I believe, is a librarian. The other couple, I'm not sure what they do professionally. I think one of them teaches at Berkeley. I'm not really certain, but they only began the dreidlach out of frustration, and that's what they've been doing. They have a place, they now call it the Dreidel Factory, and it's, you know, it's a mini business, but it's doing very well. This is their third year, and they're making them and selling them. I did correspond with them and say, hey, you know, you guys are doing real well, and I like what you're doing. Why not go into other Jewish toys? Why don't you try even a new version of the Purim Grogger? And they were toying with that idea of doing more toys. I don't know whether they will or not. A lot of the other artists who are really full-time artists, rather than, let's say, these are what I would call cottage industry craftspeople, will work in Judaica some of the time. And then, like myself, I've participated in two bicentennial graphics productions as well, portfolios that we did to honor the 10 crucial days, and then Princeton's involvement in the bicentennial. So I will work in any design area, but Jewish motifs are for me the most involving because it best expresses totally who I am, Jewish, female, 20th century, now it's who I am. Some of the artists do, I'd say, half Jewish work and half secular work. Some, on the other hand, like Ludwig Wolpert at the Jewish Museum, his work is totally involved with Judaic themes. Most of the calligraphers, I imagine, are totally into the Judaic themes.
How long has your art been centered on Judaism?
I'd say centered on Judaism for about the past 8 years. Yeah. In that, let's see, 8 years, yeah. 8 years. 9 years ago, I was 30, and I was coming back from Spain. We'd lived in Spain for 4 years, and I had been merrily doing lots of landscapes, etchings mainly of landscapes, and had a number of one-woman shows in Europe and South America. We lived in a number of places. I just had the last of my three children. She, a little girl, she was then 1 year old. We were sitting on the plane going back. It was my birthday, so it was just... My birthday was 2 days ago, so it was just 9 years ago. And I thought, okay, now everything is going to change. We're not going to live in Spain anymore. We're going back, you know, to home. I really want to see if I can't get my act together, both the female bit, the Jewish bit, everything into my new expression, because it's sort of time to change and identify. It didn't happen very easily because I was... I really was sort of ridden by the cliches that abound in Jewish art. And until you become very familiar with your techniques and also with the possibilities that Jewish art doesn't have to mean just a blue and white Star of David, you know, or some little curly lamb in the middle of a white ground or something. You can really express all sorts of thematic material and all sorts of joyous material. It takes a while, I think, to break through the cliches. And initially, I became very involved in doing a set of etchings dealing with Holocaust material. It was quite somber. And I read a lot of Elie Wiesel. In fact, he has a couple of my prints. And it turned me on tremendously. But I would get more and more morbid dealing with Holocaust material. And I began to feel that, wait a minute, I've always felt so happy about being Jewish. It was always such a turn-on. It's so pleasant and fun. And my Jewish childhood was very much a matter of this is what we do and enjoy, rather than we can't write on Shabbos, or we can't, or we don't. I never thought of Judaism as a don't do, but more of a let's play kind of thing. And so after this whole Holocaust immersion, which was very good for me, very growing and learning to handle themes and visual imagery and so on, my work began to shift into a more, let's say, positive expression, a forward-looking and more playful thing. And also I began to work more in the crafts again.
It seems that you'd probably have a bit of a different relationship with your audience, both people who come to view your shows and who are interested in purchasing work. On the one hand, perhaps maybe your audience is limited, i.e. limited to people who have an interest in Judaica. And two, on the other hand, some people might buy your work just because it does relate to Judaism, and that's for them reason enough. Yeah. And from then, perhaps you wouldn't get the kind of feedback as to the specifics of your work that you'd get if it was, more abstract.
Yeah, I know just what you mean, though I've had some odd experiences that was sort of unsettling and taught me a great deal. I found that many Jews would come and see my work, both at shows or in the studio, and they would indeed be unsettled by the thematic material, and they'd say, really, I love it, May, but I can't live with that. Could you show me a landscape or, you know, a butterfly or something pretty? And, you know, I've always kept doing that. I like to do pretty things. I also did a set of prints dealing with, let's say, the feminist or woman's position. Those have always sold very well, too. So people would look at the more sort of astringent things and then buy the pretty things. On the other hand, many non-Jews have bought the what I call the Holocaust material because, especially during the Cambodian and the Vietnamese periods and post that era, because when I work using Judaic themes, my feeling is that the Jewish message is really a universal one, in that whatever has happened to the Jewish people isn't, you know, it's just that we have been selected out to be pushed down or murdered or so on. It's sort of emblematic of what's happening in the world. And so when I did a painting, rather large one, called "The Sky Is Their Cemetery, The Clouds Their Tombstones," for me, that meant the victims of the Holocaust who just vaporized into thin air. It was bought by Douglas College, by the senior class, for the library, because, the senior class 2 years ago, because they felt that it really encompassed a lot of their feelings about what had happened to the Vietnamese and the Cambodian refugees, that they too just disappeared. And the imagery is really the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Has it ever been hard for you to integrate your feminist beliefs with your Judaistic beliefs?
No.
You don't see a conflict there?
I don't see a conflict. And I think that's because, as my husband says, I'm so much of a feminist that I don't have time for feminism. And I can't become really dogmatic about it. I do what I want, and I don't allow things or positions to hold me back. Therefore, I can't be such a radical feminist that I would wish my three very marvelous and very definitely planned for children to be aborted at their present age. I mean, that's the very radical edge of feminism is,
well, I don't know. Think they're necessarily related at all, really.
Well, they're not, and they are. I mean, if we're going to extremes, in the same way you have your very orthodox point of view of Judaism and your very orthodox point of view of feminism, well, yeah, you're going to have some kinds of conflict. But in that, I feel myself a feminist in terms of wanting and being able to do whatever it is that I want to do and not be held back, and equal pay for equal work, and, you know, just open opportunities no special privileges, like, you know, being served first at a table and then last when it comes to a job, you know, this kind of thing.
It seems that the Reform section of Judaism has made the most evident and tangible steps towards having equality within the synagogue and within the Jewish community. Can I ask you what type of Judaism you belong to, and how you feel about the Reform movement?
Yeah, in my general keeping with everything else that I don't belong to, I'm basically non-affiliated. Mm-hmm. And I feel sometimes quite at home in an Orthodox synagogue, only sometimes, because there are times I really like the idea of being separated from the men. But that's only sometimes. Basically, I think I'm most at home in a conservative synagogue, which is, let's say, very open. Our conservative synagogue in Princeton allows and encourages women to read Torah, to have aliyahs, to be part of the minyan, to, in fact, fully participate in the ritual. And to me, this is really very fine. A friend of mine yesterday celebrated with her daughter's bat mitzvah, and this very beautiful girl read the whole Torah passage, conducted the entire service, and her mother descends from the line of Kohanim, or a high priest. And so her mother had the first aliyah, or call up to the Torah. And, of course, I like that tremendously. And what is it? It is very refreshing to realize that, you know, there are many, many women now studying for the rabbinate, and within 20 years, we're going to have probably about 50% female rabbis in the United States. And it's going to take a while to get used to. It used to be the joke that a woman would go to rabbinical school only to meet a rabbi, right?
Right.
You know, like the reason for going to college is only to meet a guy, right?
Yeah. But there'll be some changes, I guess.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so.
We've kind of strayed from the topic of the Jewish Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
I thought I'd bring up one point. Whenever any kind of ethnic heritage is in discussion, there always seems to be a kind of competition going on between who makes the best type of food specific to that culture. There's a lot of arguments, especially in New York City, I think, as to where the best pizza can be found, whether it's in Brooklyn or in Italy. And I'm wondering, I know you have a section on food and specifically on bagels. Yes?
Yeah.
Did you test taste them at all? Did
Well, I must admit to having had a fair number of lunches at Michelle's Deli in Princeton, mainly because I live in Princeton. I did test the other places too, just because they're good. How can you walk into a place like that and not try something? It just smells so good. People have asked me about a number of other delicatessens, their favorites. You know, I say, well, what about, let's say, Zabar's in New York? And the problem with Zabar's is that it will not mail order. And it's very nice to list Zabar's, but if you're out, let's say, in Colorado and you're desperate for a piece of lox, well, Zabar's will mail order coffee, any kind. But
How can you mail order, though, bagels or lox or any kind of food that you know, is perishable, and
the good bagels
don't use preservatives in them.
Right. No, they'll pack things in dry ice and air freight them and guarantee that it will be there with the dry ice intact in 2 days.
No kidding.
Yeah, now,
must
you know,
be an
hopefully...
an expensive bagel.
Oh, very expensive, really. I mean, when you're talking about lox and all these smoked fishes, it's expensive to begin with, so I guess it's like, you know, having a lobster delivered packed in ice. I mean, people do that. I guess I'm lucky to live close enough to Michelle's to not have to do that.
Okay, if you're just tuning in now, I'm talking to May Shafter Rockland, who's the author of a book called The Jewish Yellow Pages, which is a guide to services and to artists and to food that is related to Judaism. We're going to change gears a bit now and talk a bit about Hanukkah, a holiday that we are now in the middle of, celebrated by the Jewish people. May has written a book called The Hanukkah Book, which is published by Schocken Books. I'd like to talk a bit about the history of the holiday. Can we go back to the beginning and get a straight story about it?
All right, I'll try for a straight story about it. Let's say roughly, well, in the second century before the Common Era, what we know now as Israel, Judea, was in the control of the Syrians. It's so somehow current that it makes me feel so current. You can almost follow the whole thing that happened on a current map right out of the newspaper. Israel was a passageway between Egypt and Syria, right along the coast. And the Syrians, led by Antiochus, the wicked king, wanted to establish a very monolithic and unified empire, including Judea. And in order to do that, and they wanted this really because one of the plans of Antiochus was to perhaps take on Egypt and really control an even larger area. And in order to fight abroad, he felt he needed a unified kingdom or empire behind him. To make this unified, he began to enforce the unity of peoples. Everybody had to be exactly alike, which meant worshiping the same gods, speaking the same language, wiping out all local differences. He was very successful in general. And in Jerusalem itself, which was a sophisticated capital, many Jews were so Hellenized that they could see no harm in going along with a lot of what he wanted. But he and, I guess, the Jerusalem high priest didn't really count on the conservative nature of most of the Jewish population. What Antiochus did was he then proceeded to set up statues of himself in the synagogues and in the temple, because, of course, he was God made manifest, and then people would worship him, and everybody who got to be king got to be God in those days, in that kind of world. When he then, you know, many Jews then left Jerusalem, they really couldn't hack that and took to the hills. Among those who left was a family led by Mattathias, an old man, family we now call the Maccabees. It was really the Hasmonean family. And when, in fact, Antiochus began to set up more and more of these, let's say, statues, and insist that people would follow the Greco-Syrian rites of celebration in the small towns, they even followed Mattathias and his family into Modi'in, a small town outside of Jerusalem, not too far outside. And when they came to this town and were having, you know, their, let's say, their entry pageant and celebration, now here we are, and in honor of this big thing, we're going to sacrifice a pig on the statue, and we will all partake of this feast. And, you know, it's all this nice sort of homey festival. There was, in fact, a Jew who said, okay, we go along, they won't make trouble, we'll go up there, and he will eat of this pig. Well, Mattathias wouldn't stand for it, and he killed the Jew. At this point, all hell broke loose, and the Greek soldiers or the Syrian soldiers began slaying other people, and Mattathias and his crowd wiped out this small Greek contingent or Greco-Syrian contingent that had come down from Jerusalem to enforce the new rites. Once having wiped out this small force, they then, you know, realized at any minute the rest of the heavies would come down from Jerusalem. And so Mattathias said, anyone who is for the Lord, follow me. And the menfolk all took to the hills, and taking with them, some of the women, some of the children, and whatever farm implements they had to use as weapons. From that beginning, a guerrilla warfare began. It was basically a militia type of army, a citizen army. It was fed by the local people. So you had the guerrillas living in the mountains, and it was very much like, let's say, a Vietnamese or Cambodian type of thing, where they were sustained by the local population. The war, in fact, went on for 25 years until the last of Mattathias' son, Simon, did in fact live to see a united and free Judea. Again, he then was able to coin money and say Judea is a free country. This lasted precious few years until Rome came along and then gobbled it all up. In the first 3 years, however, the Maccabees did manage to retake the temple. When they retook the temple and cleansed it, they had a Chanukah or dedication ceremony. And they modeled that early, if you're interested in the history of the holiday, not just the history of the origins of it. This, in fact, is one of the only holidays that we really have an accurate historic account of its beginning. It was a military holiday. Well, when the Maccabees retook the temple, they found it a shambles, and it was quite, you know, it was just broken up. It had been used as a garrison. It had been used for athletic events, for all kinds of things. They cleaned it up, and they went to relight the lamp, the menorah, seven-branched lamp, which, in fact, was kindled daily and always stood. Now, the story is told, and in fact, this story was made up several centuries after the actual rededication. The story is told that when they went to rekindle the lamp, there was only enough oil for one day, but it miraculously burnt for the 8 days that would be required to manufacture clean oil. Now, in reality, this is a lovely explanation for the fact that we light lights or candles during the Hanukkah period. lighting the lights has nothing to do with the origins of Hanukkah, which, as I said, is a military thing. But the reality is, of course, that people have always been lighting fires in the middle of the winter, especially, well, all over the world, not just in the Middle East. We light lights in the middle of the winter because we're scared of the dark. It's cold, and maybe the sun won't really start to shine again. So if you light a light, it may bring back, reilluminate the sun. Apparently that worked, so people did it again and again. You know, they light bonfires, or all of our winter lighting celebrations, the Yule light, the Christmas tree lighting, all of them stem from these same very basic, very primitive feelings. And so when the Jews had to explain why they were lighting lights at this time, they said, well, there was a miracle of the oil. In reality, I like to think of this lighting lights as, let's say, a poetic substitution. The miracle of survival can be represented in, and the miracle of religious freedom can now be represented in the lights.
How do you feel about menorah as symbol? Menorah as symbol that is used in many commercial institutions and stores, lobbies, to be placed alongside with Christmas tree as symbol or Santa Claus as symbol of a holiday.
In that sense, I don't like it. No, I really don't. The menorah is the oldest and most authentic Jewish symbol. It's based on the Tree of Life motif. It sort of combines a very earthly form and a heavenly kind of aspiration. And to stand it around and to begin to use it as a quick ornament and a commercial come-on, I don't like it. I don't like to see, I wouldn't like to see Hanukkah blown up into, let's say, as one of my reviewers called it, she said, Hanukkah is not just Christmas in drag. Well, I would hate to see Hanukkah inflated in such an artificial manner. It's a simple domestic holiday. It has greater meaning for us now than it had before, not only because of the push of Christmas, but because Israel has been reborn. I can't imagine the Jews in the ghettos of the 18th century or in the walled cities of the Middle Ages celebrating a military victory. I mean, can you imagine having a military parade, let's say? It would be, you know, an invitation for a pogrom. It's enough that we were having pogroms during Easter when theoretically, you know, we were turning Christian children into matzahs. I mean, why look for trouble? So, yeah, we would kindle the lamp in a very low-key kind of celebration, basically to say, we live, Israel still lives in this little light, you know, and you look at them, and all you're meant to do with these lights is really to look at them and remember that there's a past and there's a future. And that's it. And to then make it into a big brouhaha now commercially doesn't make any sense. But to have more zest for it, sure, because Israel's been reborn.
Okay, May, I want to thank you very much for joining us this afternoon on Fresh Air. I've been talking with May Shafter-Rockland, and we've been talking about basically two of her books and her own personal experiences. Her books that we've referred to are the Hanukkah book, which is published by Schocken Books and was published, I believe, last year.
Yeah.
And the Jewish Yellow Pages, which is her latest work, which, as I've been saying, is a kind of guide to various goods and services throughout the country that have to do with Judaism, from art to bagels and everything in between. That's also published by Schocken Books. I wish you the best, May, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here.
You're listening to Fresh Air.